It's a terrific pleasure to be here. I have very, very many friends in the physics department, in the high energy physics group, both in theory and experiment. And in fact, our groups between Princeton and Rutgers are coming together, both theoreticians such as myself, as well as our respective experimental groups, to really work with each other very intensively in preparation for this wonderful experiment that's going to start hopefully by the end of the year this year, which is going to be the focus of my talk. Can everyone see this? Should we bring it down a little more?
Sure.
Very good. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, and everyone can hear me. All right. So the experiment is the Large Hadron Collider. This is an aerial view around Geneva, Switzerland. Those are the Swiss-French Alps in the background. It's pretty close to the, actually this ring intersects the border of Switzerland and France. And of course from the air you don't see this giant red circle on the ground. But what we have under the ground there is a ring around 28 kilometers around. Around this ring, we accelerate the proton. Protons. The proton is one of the constituents of the nucleus of the atom. So for example, the hydrogen atom is made out of a proton, which is in the nucleus, and an electron that spins around it. So we take the protons, and we accelerate them to go really, really fast. I'll tell you a little more detail. Well, I'll tell you now. They go around 0.9999999989, the speed of light. There's one set of protons going around the ring that fast, and another set of protons going around the ring in the opposite direction that fast. And every now and then, and at two places on opposite sides of this ring, those sets of protons are made to smash into each other at incredibly high energies. And what the point is, why we do this, what we hope to learn, is the topic of the lecture. But banging those protons into each other at incredibly high energies is going to probe the fundamental laws of nature at incredibly tiny distances, around 10 times smaller than we've ever probed today. This experiment is remarkable. It's the largest experiment in human history. Not only the actual experiment itself, this is not only the 28 kilometer ring, but also the number of people involved is just off any normal scale. At least the parts of the experiments that I'm going to be focusing on are two separate collaborations with about 3,000 people each working on them. So, you know, anyone who's dealt with scientists knows that it's like herding cats. And dealing with 3,000 people at the same time, all really after the same thing, is a really remarkable thing. And the fact that 3,000 people will bring themselves together and work together also attests to the importance of the pursuit. Okay. Let me tell you a little bit more about this experiment. So just to get an idea of how big that 28 kilometers around is, there's Manhattan, and the LHC, the radius of that ring, happens to be almost exactly the length of Central Park. Okay, so that's what the LHC would look like if it was superimposed on Manhattan. So it's big. And, like I said, you don't see this giant red thing from the sky. The actual beam sits around 300 feet beneath the ground. 300 feet is about the height of the Statue of Liberty. And this is what it actually looks like in the tunnel. Okay, so it's, first of all, 28 kilometers is really big, so you can sort of barely see the curvature here. And like I said, there are two beams, and we have protons going, being accelerated to very, very high energies. There's two sets of them, so one set goes in one of those holes, the other set goes in the other one of those holes. And so what do you actually do? What you actually do is, in order to accelerate these, in order to accelerate these particles of high energies, it's a little bit like your TV. Your television accelerates electrons to very high energies by using an electric field. So if you have a charged particle in an electric field, it'll pick up energy and it will accelerate. And that sounds great. You can just think of a big electric field and you can make a charge go further and further, but you actually want this guy to pick up more and more and more energy all the time. So it's very effective in order to do that to actually put it around in a big circle. So it keeps going, and every time it gets more and more and more of a kick. So it gets to go faster and faster. You also want to get another set going around in the opposite direction, and you can set it up very cleverly so that you don't actually use an electric field which is standing still. You use an electric field that oscillates back and forth, and things are timed very accurately so that when one set of guys when the guys that you're trying to accelerate in this direction are moving, the electric field is pointing in that direction, and when the guys are trying to accelerate the other way around, moving is oscillating in the opposite direction. But what you need to do in order to stick it in a ring and get it to go around in a circle, you have to bend this beam. And you bend it with a magnet. And, you know, people who don't really respect their TVs that much have played this game too. you can use a magnet as, well, you know what magnets do to televisions if you've played with it. So, same thing happens here. A charged particle in a magnetic field will bend. So actually, you need giant, giant magnets in order to bend them when they're moving so fast. And in fact, you need them to be pointed in opposite directions, each one of those two beams, so that we bend them and keep them going around in the same circle. Okay, now I have a confession to make. Those slightly whiz-bang slides were not mine. They're made by an experimental colleague of mine. I am incapable of making slides like that. So you'll be seeing pictures like this. This is the difference between a theorist and an experimentalist. Okay? So you'll be seeing a lot more pictures like this. And to the extent that there's any whiz-bang slides, I may have one more that's also stolen from my colleague. Let me now talk again about what we're actually doing in this experiment. And I'll start talking about why. Now we have some idea of the scale. So like I said, we take protons and we accelerate them to these very, very high speeds, 0.999999999 times the speed of light. It's a proton going one way, proton going the other way. The proton itself is a composite particle. It's made up of stuff. And we've known this for about 40 years. It has a size. The size of the proton is around 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. Just to give you an idea of the scale, the size of an atom is around 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. Okay, so the proton is around a million times smaller than the atom. So let's take a magnifying glass. That's my sad rendition of a magnifying glass. Let's take a magnifying glass, look at the proton. And first of all, paradoxically, it shrinks a little bit. I don't know why that happened. But anyway, what you actually see if you look inside the proton is it's actually made up out of things. It's made out of things that we call quarks. So if you remember anything about high school physics, you'll remember the proton has a charge of 1. It's an electric charge of 1. These quarks actually have, therefore, stands to reason, fractional charges. So a proton is made out of 2 up quarks and a down quark, and the electric charge of the up quark is actually 2/3, and the electric charge of the down quark is minus 1/3. So 2/3 plus 2/3 minus 1/3 is equal to 1, except the electric charge of the proton. But these are actually the fundamental constituents, these up and down quarks. We actually haven't seen an up and down quark just sitting there in our hand anywhere out there in nature. And that's because they're actually glued to each other by an interaction called the strong force that's mediated by imaginably called gluons. Okay? So there's also particles in this proton called gluons, which are constantly being exchanged back and forth between these up and down quarks that hold everything in. So that's like a bag. You should think of a proton like a bag that's around 10 to the minus 14 centimeters big, that inside it has these up quarks and down quarks and gluons. Okay, so that's one proton here, that's another proton there. They're both going really fast. We have these two bags, they smash into each other. What should happen? Well, most of the time, what happens is they just break apart. Okay? This one bag, another bag, and smashing it looks like a big head-on car collision. Right? Mostly what happens is they just break apart, and you get a spray of particles going this way, and a spray of particles going that way. If they're smashing into each other like that, just get a big spray of particles going this way, big spray of particles going the other way. We actually don't care about that so much. We're not, you know, completely violently inclined. It's not the breakup that interests us so much. What interests us instead is using these very high energies to probe what's going on at very, very short distances. And that happens much more rarely. That happens much more rarely when one of these quarks here and the other one of those quarks there, which as far as we know are actually point-like. What happens is every now and then they suffer a head-on collision. And the result of those, and what happens is they collide, something new happens, and that new stuff comes off at relatively large angles compared to this beam axis. Okay. So mostly, you smash them into each other, stuff goes off this way, stuff goes off that way. Every now and then, the underlying fundamental constituents suffer a hard collision. And you know that it was a hard collision because something comes off at 90 degrees or 80 degrees or 70 degrees or something. Those of you who remember, again, probably from high school physics classes, how Rutherford discovered that things were made out of atoms, that there was an atomic nucleus. Rutherford did an experiment that was very, very much like this. He fired electrons at a little thin film of gold, and every now and then he noticed that electrons came off backwards, and they came off backwards because it was banging off this tiny constituent of the nucleus. Okay, now, when we accelerate these things to these very high energies, the distances that are probed turn out to be around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. Okay, so that's what we're after. We're after trying to figure out what's going on at distances of order 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. So something new happens. They bang into each other, something new happens. This scale is around a billion times smaller than the atom. And that something new tends to be the production of new kinds of particles that we haven't seen so far. I'll come back to this story a little bit later, but let's just say for now that that all this energy, and according to Einstein, equals mc squared. So all this energy in the protons, actually these energy contained in the underlying constituents, can go and be created into mass. And they can be created as a mass of new kinds of particles, new kinds of things that we haven't seen yet. But unfortunately, these things don't come out wearing little name tags saying what they are. In fact, these typical new particles that we produce are very, very short-lived. Their lifetime is around 10 to the minus 27 seconds. 10 to the minus 27 seconds is how long it takes light to traverse the distance of around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. So this is the length scale we're talking about everywhere here. 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, 10 to the minus 27 seconds. This new stuff comes out, and it very quickly decays to ordinary particles, things that we know and love. Things like electrons, anti-electrons, positrons, maybe the quarks, maybe other particles, muons, other things like that. And it's by looking at the pattern of what comes out that we try to gain some information about what the structure of the new laws of nature that might be being revealed at these incredibly tiny distances. Just to tell you a little bit more, so this is the basic underlying interaction that we care about. The two protons smash into each other. But actually, in order to make sure that anything interesting happens at a sufficiently high rate, people actually have to put these protons, it's not, you know, you don't just send in one proton on one side, another proton on the other side. You get actually big bunches of protons. Take a bunch of protons, was in one way, bunch was in around the other way. Each bunch will maybe have 100 billion protons in it, and there's around 3,000 of these bunches that are passing through each other. Crossing through, passing through each other around every 30 nanoseconds. Okay. So it's this incredibly high rate. In order to make sure that every now and then this incredibly rare thing happens, where that guy bangs into that guy and does something interesting, so that that happens at a sufficiently high rate that we can study. Now, something that's very let me also make another point, which we'll also come back to a little bit. We're interested in seeing what's going on at very short distances. I'll explain why a little later. But you might wonder, why is it that if we want to study what's going on at very short distances, we have to collide things into each other at incredibly high energies? Why can't you build a little, you know, Fantastic Voyage spacecraft and just, you know, make it really, really small and just go down and, you know, in principle, just see what's going on at very tiny distances? Now, the reason we can't do that is quantum mechanics. The reason we can't do that is there's a very fundamental limitation that's given by the uncertainty principle of Heisenberg, that you can't actually know what's going on at very, very short times without having lots and lots of energy. You can't know what's going on at very, very short distances without having lots and lots of momentum. It's a real fundamental difference between a sort of classical picture of the world and the way the world actually is. In order to go to very, very short distances, we need very, very high energies. And we can't just do it. And what would actually go wrong is if you made this little spacecraft and you made it smaller and smaller and smaller, you tried to make the Fantastic Voyage spacecraft, you find that the spacecraft itself becomes really, really jittery and has lots and lots of energy and would break apart. So to actually probe what's going on at very short distances, we need very, very high energies. There's no other way of doing it. And that leads to a kind of wonderful irony. We're building these experiments to probe the tiniest distances. First experiment has got to be itself the most gigantic experiment, because we need this huge ring to accelerate things to the very, very high energy so we can smash them into each other. And secondly, we need the largest detectors that have ever been built in order to study what comes out of these collisions. So there are two detectors. This is one of them. It's called the Atlas detector. That beam is coming through a hole there. Okay, and you see, there's a person. Okay? So this detector is something like 40 meters tall. Why is it so big? It's so big because these particles that are coming out of that collision are going incredibly fast. They have a huge amount of energy. So to have any idea what happened, you have to be able to measure how much energy they have, what direction they're coming out, and so on. You have to be able to stop them. But they're going so fast, they don't stop very easily. So you have to surround them with gigantic quantities of just various kinds of material just in order to stop what comes out and study how much energy it had, what direction it's moving in, and so on. So it's ironic that to study the tiniest distances, we need the largest machine and the largest detectors that have ever been built. The other one, which is actually the experiment that the Rutgers group works on, is called CMS. The C stands for compact. It's small, you see. Okay. It's also pretty gigantic. It surrounds, again, the beam would be coming through that hole, and things collide into each other. All these particles come out. And so what you see, what you're actually looking for, is the debris of those collisions. So something exciting happened in this event. You know it's exciting because there's stuff coming off at big angles compared to, you know, going just in and out. So something hard thing happened that kicked things out at hard angles. And you have to measure everything about what's coming out here in order to get an idea of what it is that actually happened. And these are the most sophisticated detectors also that have ever been built. This is the inner part of that CMS detector. And the technology is really a lot like what's in your digital camera. So these are just strips of silicon just right in the most inner part of the detector, except it's like a camera with an area of a 25-meter swimming pool. And again, to give you an idea of the scale, if any of you have been to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, you'll recognize the Hayden Planetarium. The Alvis detector is about as tall as the Hayden Planetarium. This poor little CMS detector is much smaller. There it is. Okay, not all that much smaller. And, you know, these are gigantic projects. Thousands of people work on them. And since, I would say about, since the 1940s, we've gone to short distances by about a factor of 1,000. In the 1940s, we started probing what's going on at around 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. And now, 60 years later, we're probing what's going on at 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. So this going about a factor of 10 to shorter distances is now something that happens once about a generation. The planning and thinking about these experiments takes on the order of 20, 30 years, and it's now a once in a generation thing. They're getting more and more, they're getting larger, more complex. So we're very lucky, especially those of us working on the subject, we're incredibly lucky to be living in the era where we're taking one of these about a factor of 10 steps. Because the previous set of accelerators that are probing short distances have gone to about 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. So we're really taking another factor of 10 step inside. And people often say this, and I think it's true, this is a lot like what building cathedrals was like in the Middle Ages. Another example of very large-scale projects that took often generations, many, many generations to complete. And I think particle accelerators are our modern-day equivalent of cathedrals. Okay, so let me now step back and try to put try to put the subject and why we're doing this experiment in some context. So I'm going to go through a little bit of history and then tell you what the next step might be and what we might know on the 2 to 3 year time scale. So let me back up and remind you that what we know about in nature, everything that we know, certainly everything that happens in the physical universe, we've boiled down to being associated with four basic interactions. Gravity keeps the Earth going around the sun, keeps our feet to the Earth, so on. Electromagnetism, that primitive human beings knew about from lightning bolts and the fact that various kinds of rocks seem to be magnetic. So these were interactions that were known for a very long time. And in the 20th century, we became aware of two other important interactions, the weak interaction and the strong interaction. The weak interaction is responsible for radioactivity. So you know that the nucleus of the atom is made up of neutrons and protons. So the helium atom, for example, has two protons and two neutrons in it. But if you took one of those neutrons, just took a neutron out of the nucleus and just left it out there in outer space, it would decay in some minutes. It disintegrates in minutes. It disintegrates to a proton, an electron, and something called a neutrino. The interaction that's responsible for it disintegrating is called the weak interaction. And that's what's also responsible for all the rest of radioactivity. The fact that some nuclei, over like uranium, over a long time, decay to other nuclei is due to the weak interactions. The strong interactions, meanwhile, explain something which is very puzzling when you think about the helium nucleus, for example, being made up of two protons and two neutrons. You know that like charges repel each other. So how come we have these two protons sitting there snugly 10 to the minus 14 centimeters apart from each other? How come they're not just incredibly repelling each other? Well, there's a much stronger force, imaginably called the strong force, stronger than the electric propulsion that keeps them bound together. Today we realize that this is actually, I told you about the strong force that was responsible for keeping the quarks inside the proton that had to do with the gluons. And today we realize that this is actually a residual of that fundamental underlying strong interaction. So those are four basic interactions. And also everything that we know about and that we've seen in nature so far spans a very large range of distances. So the biggest distance at which we've seen anything is around 10 to the 28 centimeters. It's about the size of the universe. That's about the size of the observable universe. And it's really remarkable that almost every factor of 10, as you go to shorter distances, something interesting happens. There's some phenomenon, some cool thing which happens. I haven't listed all of them. I've listed some of my favorites. So, around a million times smaller than the universe are galaxies. Galaxies are around a million times smaller than the universe. If we go a little further down, the solar systems, maybe 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14 centimeters big, the size of the radii of the planets. If we go further down to around the meter scale, we have people, DNA, atoms, it's at around 10 to the minus 8 centimeters big, and protons and neutrons, which are around 10 to the minus 14 centimeters big. And this 10 to the minus 17 centimeters is, which is the length here we're about to go to with the LHC, happens to have independent interesting significance. This is one of the things that makes the LHC particularly exciting. People have been going to short distances to see what's there for 50, 100 years now, and mostly they went to short distances for the heck of it. That's where the frontier was, and that's fine. But here, actually, we have completely independent reasons to suspect there's something going on. People have known that there was something special about this tiny length scale, 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, for around 70 years. They've known that it's associated with some kind of physics, some interaction, something interesting has to happen at around this 10 to the minus 17 centimeter scale. It's called the weak scale. And I should also say, I will sometimes switch back and forth between talking about distances, like 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, and talking about energies. Remember, the relationship is to go to shorter distances, you need higher energies. So the energy contained in these protons is around 1,000 times the energy that's contained just in the equals mc squared energy of just one proton sitting there. So that energy scale is a tera electron volt. That's 10 to the 12 electron volts. And just so we have an idea of how big that energy is, if you picked up a grain of sand and you flipped it, that grain of sand would have an energy of about a tera electron volt. That doesn't sound like a lot, except we're taking all that energy and concentrating it into a single particle. Okay. That grain of sand is around 1,000 billion times bigger than the proton. So we're taking all of that energy, concentrating to a single particle. That scale is often people will abbreviate as the TeV scale. So every now and then I might say the TeV scale. And that, as an energy scale, is exactly the same as this 10 to the minus 17 centimeter scale, as a length scale. So we've known for a long time that something interesting is going on at the TeV scale, so it's very interesting that we're about to go there now. So it's not just exciting because it happens to be the frontier. It is the frontier, but we also know independently that something should be happening there. Okay. So let's back up a little more and put this. Everything that I told you in the last transparency takes place between these two scales. So now I'm cleaning up and only focusing on the length scales that we have talked about a lot in fundamental physics. So the size of the universe we care about in cosmology this week, the length scale, has some significance that I'll tell you about in a second. At much, much shorter distances, there's another interesting length scale known as the Planck length. That's around 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Now, what is that? That's the length scale that gets the most press. Okay. So if we go down to incredibly short distances, a very basic fact about the world around us, which we'll come back to, is that gravity is much, much weaker force than all the other forces. If you take two electrons, there's an electric repulsion between them, and a gravitational attraction. And the electric repulsion is 42 orders of magnitude stronger than the gravitational attraction. So gravity is much, 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 much weaker than all the other forces. But if you ask, if we take these electrons and push them closer and closer and closer together, at some distance, the forces won't become comparable to each other. The forces become comparable to each other again because when we go to very short distances due to this uncertainty principle, I have to put more and more energy into those electrons. That energy, because of E equals mc squared, is more and more mass. And that mass gravitates, so there's more and more gravitational attraction. So if I go to incredibly short distances, finally, gravity becomes as strong as everything else. That happens at around 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And when that happens, all hell breaks loose. We really know there's just something wrong. We can't take our known laws of nature and figure out what's going on there. This is the subject of quantum gravity, and it's associated with string theory and related ideas. And the essential problem, I can tell you in 2 minutes, the essential problem is that at these distances, our notion of space and time must break down. That's for a very simple reason. If we're trying to measure what's going on in incredibly tiny times, I told you about 10 times now, we have to use very, very high energies. So that's fine. If I want to measure even shorter times, I have to use even larger energies. But at some point, something goes wrong. Because I go to shorter and shorter distances, I need more and more energy. But at some point, I put so much energy into such a tiny region of space that now it has so much mass that that region of space collapses into a black hole. That's bad. Why is that bad? Well, I was trying to figure out what's going on there, right? I'm trying to look. So Heisenberg tells me that I can't build a fantastic white spaceship. Okay, I asked for bajillions of dollars from Congress. I build a giant particle accelerator. I go to very, very, very high energies. But I find that the exact region I was trying to look at is collapsing into a black hole. And if I say, oh shoot, let me try even harder, I'll ask for even more money, maybe to build an even bigger accelerator, even more energy, what happens? Make a bigger black hole. So that means that we just know from this very simple thought experiment that there is no way we can measure very, very short distances and times. They have no operational meaning. And every time this happens to us before in physics, where some concept can't even operationally be measured or defined, it means that concept is an approximate one. It's not a fundamental one. But now what we're talking about is space and time. So we have to replace space and time with something else. That's associated with physics at this length scale. Now you'll notice that's around 16 orders of magnitude smaller than this scale. But actually, every single one of these scales is associated with a crisis in our understanding. So this is the one that gets the most press. But there's two other ones, which I will describe in some detail. Let me just tell you what they're about. They're about another incredibly obvious fact about our world, that these scales are incredibly well separated from each other. It's a remarkable fact that our universe is big. You know, it's made out of atoms. Actually, atoms aren't fundamental. They're made out of protons and electrons and quarks. We have all these very, very short microscopic distance scales. And yet, we have a macroscopic world. There's an enormous separation between the size of the universe, this weak length, and the Planck length. And this turns out to actually be incredibly puzzling from a theoretical point of view, for a reason that I will tell you about shortly. So, for instance, that enormous separation is equivalent to why is the universe big? Why isn't the universe 10 to the minus 33 centimeters big? If that's some fundamental short distance scale, why isn't the universe that big? Also, the fact that there is this enormous separation between the weak length and the Planck length will turn out to be, as you'll see, equivalent to the question, why isn't gravity actually 30 orders of magnitude stronger than it is? Why aren't we all black holes? Why does gravity appear to be weak? These are incredibly simple questions that you would think should have simple answers, and they have horrible answers in our current view. Completely unbelievable answers. Which also makes us suspect that we're missing something very big. So, these are the three interesting length scales that we talk about in fundamental physics, and they each have a very major problem associated with them. I'm going to talk about these two in some more detail now. But I really want to stress, the level at which I'm explaining them is not very far removed from the actual level at which it's understood. What's nice about these questions is that they're very big, they're very simple to state, and they very clearly indicate that we're missing something. And the solution to at least one of them must show up at the LHC. All right. But now let me finish the putting things in some historical context by telling you why we go to short distances. Why are we so obsessed with studying things at very, very small scales? The reason we're obsessed with it is that for 400 years, physics has been on a trajectory where very, very disparate phenomena seem to be explained in a common way. And very, very disparate things are seen to be different aspects of the same underlying phenomenon. This started with Newton. Newton realized that the same force of gravity that made the apple fall kept the moon going around the Earth. This we teach now in kindergarten, or wherever we teach it. Maybe high school. I'm kidding. But it's completely unobvious, right? I mean, this is a real act of genius. For one thing, you know, the moon seems to be going around, the apple seems to be falling. It's not at all clear that they're related to each other. But it is. It's exactly the same force, exactly the same phenomena. And that unification of all of these things went on to make lots of other predictions. It explained everything about the solar system and comets and really the basis of the scientific revolution. But this just kept going on and on. We have electricity and magnetism. These things seem to be totally unrelated to each other. And yet, we learned in the 1800s that there are different aspects of exactly the same thing. Electromagnetism. That's not at all obvious. But not only are they different aspects of the same thing, a third thing, which shouldn't seem to have anything to do with the first two, light. Light was understood to itself be an electromagnetic wave. And just oscillating electric fields and magnetic fields are what we call a light beam or a light wave. And things got much more interesting in the last century. Special relativity taught us that space and time were actually different aspects of the same thing. Space-time. This led to a number of very unexpected connections. For example, energy and mass ended up being related. E equals mc squared. That had amazing consequences. General relativity went on when Einstein realized that actually, not only are space and time the same, different aspects of the same thing, space-time, but space-time isn't a completely static thing. It's not just an arena where everything happens. Now, people thought for 300 years before that, that space and time was just where stuff happened. But it's not just, it isn't just a passive arena. It's dynamical. It can bend, it can curve. And the curvature of space and time is actually gravity. A second thing that didn't seem to have anything to do with the first two. Okay. So the reason why the Earth goes around the Sun is that actually the Sun bends space and time so that the Earth going around the Sun is actually the Earth taking the shortest possible path it can in space-time. And this had remarkable consequences. Once you realize that space-time isn't just some static arena, you're even allowed to contemplate things that aren't even possible to think about when you think they are just a static arena. For instance, you all know that the universe is expanding. This is a concept that you can't even talk about without realizing that space and time can be dynamical. The universe isn't expanding into anything. It's not like an explosion where things are just moving apart from each other. That would have some center. Okay? There isn't some bigger space into which things are expanding. When we say the universe is expanding, it's really space is expanding. If I have a galaxy here and a galaxy there, at a later time, there's just more space between them. That space is being born. And it's just really possible. It's impossible to even talk about this without understanding these things are dynamical. So that was a remarkable prediction of general relativity, that space-time, that the universe can be expanded. This kept going with the ideas of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics thought that waves and particles are, which seem to be very different, are actually different aspects of the same thing. And in fact, it told us that there is no such thing as waves fundamentally in nature at all, but everything's a particle. But not a classical particle, but a quantum particle. And some kinds of quantum particles, like electrons, behave, when you put large groups of them together, they behave like classical particles. And other kinds of quantum mechanical particles, like photons, when you put lots and lots of them on top of each other, they behave like classical waves. But really, there's one fundamental underlying thing. There's quantum particles. Sometimes they behave like classical particles. Sometimes they behave like classical waves. And again, this had a big qualitative lesson, was the uncertainty principle that we've referred to a number of times already. I can't know something like the position and velocity, or the position and momentum, of a particle at the same time. If I know its position to some accuracy, there's a minimum amount of uncertainty in its momentum, and vice versa. So if I know that a particle is sitting there in a very small region, then there's a pretty big spread of uncertainty in where it's going, and vice versa. And similarly, if I know how much energy something has, then I don't know the amount of time that that the event that was talking about took place in, and vice versa. And there was a new constant of nature, Planck's constant, that governed this uncertainty. And again, this had dramatic new consequences that couldn't be anticipated until you understood the new unification. One of the things that upsets me a little bit is that the uncertainty principle is often discussed, especially in popular books, in relation to some kind of new agey, mystical, everything is relative way. And in fact, far from being that, this uncertainty principle is responsible for the very rock-solid stability of all matter in the world. See, you have an atom, which is an electron going around a proton. And in a world governed by classical physics, that electron would spin in very, very quickly to the nucleus, and we wouldn't have any stable matter at all. The reason why we have something like an atom, and also the reason why this atom looks the same as that atom, looks the same as that atom, they're not all each their independent little solar system, is that in fact, this electron can't spin in to the nucleus. For it to spin into the nucleus, I would have to know both where it is and how fast it's going at the same time, which I can't. So there's an inevitable jitteriness to the electron, and that's what's responsible for things being stable. The uncertainty principle is responsible for the stability of matter. All right, the big accomplishment of the last 60 years in theoretical physics was the synthesis of special relativity and quantum mechanics into something that's known as quantum field theory. And this also led to new things. It turns out not to be so easy to put special relativity and quantum mechanics together. And one of its consequences, which I can even explain, one of its consequences is that there must be antimatter. So this was not something that was known at all to people in the 1920s and 30s when they first started thinking about this. No antimatter had been seen anywhere in the world. But they just found from their equations that putting relativity and quantum mechanics together forced the existence of a whole second half of the world that no one had seen. Okay, for every particle that we knew, there had to be an antiparticle. So for the electron, there had to be a positron. For a proton, there had to be an antiproton. So it's remarkable this unification of space-time and quantum mechanics doubled the world. And I can even tell you roughly why that happens. One of the essential tenets of special relativity is that nothing can go faster than light. You guys all know that. Actually, it's easy to describe why that's the case. One of the things that fell by the wayside with special relativity was the idea that you could say that two events that happened here and here in space happened at the same time. For instance, you know, if I shot two laser beams off going in opposite directions in the middle of the room, you'd be tempted to say that they're hitting the two walls at the same time. But in fact, you can't say that, because if you're moving, if you're to another observer that's moving, let's say moving in this direction, they would actually, because the speed of light doesn't change, they would see the laser beam hit that wall before it hit that wall. And the other way around, if they're moving the other way, it would see it happen in the opposite order. Okay. So we can't say that two events that take place separated from each other happen at the same time. That means that if I have something,
if this is going forward in time and I have something happening in space, and if I have something that's going faster than light,
let's even take it very extreme. Let's say I have something that's happening instantaneously. So I turn on something here, and instantaneously an electron shows up at the other end of the room. The reason that's bad is that in another frame of reference, that would mean that the electron showed up before I turned it on. That would violate the ideas of causality.
There's always some reference frame in which, if something goes faster than light in one reference frame, there's always another reference frame where it appears that effect precedes cause.
So that's why things have to move slower than light.
But that's an essential conflict with quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics tells you, I can't really know exactly where that is. Maybe that was actually a little closer in because of the uncertainty principle. So that something got from A to B,
apparently faster than light.
It's a real tension. The way this tension is resolved is that if in one reference frame it looks like A is going to B by sending an electron to B, in the other reference frame, in order
not to have it look acausal, you have to interpret it causally, but in another way. You have to interpret it as a positive charge flowing from B to A. And everything can be nice and causal. But that means there must exist some particle in nature whose properties are identical to the electron in every way, but which has opposite charge.
So the synthesis of quantum mechanics and relativity led to the existence of antiparticles. Antiparticles, in turn, mean that we just keep going, and everything that we used to think was an arena and static and not really part of physics, but what physics happened in, becomes dynamical and exciting.
As we saw, you know, general relativity makes space and time dynamical.
Okay, that's fine. But you still, something very elementary, like the notion of vacuum, emptiness,
that wasn't changed. Special relativity and quantum mechanics, which predict the existence of antiparticles,
now even make the vacuum itself an exciting place. And that's because there's really no such thing as a vacuum.
How would you check that there's a vacuum? How would you check that there's a vacuum here?
You would build a little microscope, look to see that there is nothing going on there. Okay? There it is. You're looking. But now you want to check there's nothing going on at shorter and shorter distances. But because of the uncertainty principle, I have to put energy into that little region of space to check that there's nothing there.
But now if I have enough energy, I can have so much energy that it's easy to produce a particle and an antiparticle. That conserves everything. So it's charge, so it's energy, so I put energy into this region.
So the act of trying to check that there's nothing there reveals, a particle and an antiparticle.
And if you keep going and try to check that there's nothing going on even shorter distances, if there's other particles out there, you'll make them too. Their particle and antiparticle pairs too.
So if in a classical picture of the world, you might imagine an electron sitting there, surrounded by its electric field, in a quantum mechanical picture, it's completely different. You should think of the vacuum as roiling with particles and antiparticles.
And if you probe it at shorter and shorter distances, you'll see more of this structure. And whatever's going on, even shorter distances, you'll see even more of the particles that might be there. If they're heavier, you'll have to go to smaller distances in order to see them.
But you'll eventually see them. So this is what the vacuum actually looks like in quantum field theory. Often people call these particle accelerators giant microscopes because they probe very short distances. But you can ask, what are they looking at?
What they're looking at is the vacuum.
They're giant microscopes of the vacuum. The LHC converts the pure energy in that initial state into all these particle and antiparticle pairs that are sitting there in the vacuum and can get excited. And therefore, it is probing what's going on in this way at very, very short distances. Okay.
So those were all the essential physical ingredients that
we learned in the 20th century. And they're all synthesized into something that we call the standard model of all the interactions. So this is a theory. It combines quantum mechanics and special relativity and all the interactions that we know of. It's spectacularly successful at describing everything we've studied down to distances around 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. And I want to stress that not a single experiment contradicts it. And hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of measurements have been made, and they all agree with the predictions of this theory. Down to distances around 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. Almost all of these measurements are incredibly precise. So, you know, the experimental measurements have been made to an accuracy of 1%, 1 part in 1,000, 1 part in 10,000. The theoretical predictions can be made to the same accuracy. You compare a theory and experiment, and they just match bang on every single time. This is not just some set of pictures. It's a completely quantitative theory that describes, and is not contradicted by one experiment. A few of these experiments, sometimes in special situations, some of them, some of the experiments and theoretical predictions can be both made to much, much higher precision. And some of these things have been checked to an accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the 10, 1 part in 10 to the 11, 1 part in 10 to the 12, and they match to a theory experiment. Okay, so this is not, this is not a joke. This is a theory that really works, and But more than its quantitative successes, what we learn is that all of these interactions that I told you about, the strong force, the weak force, electromagnetism, even gravity, they all seem to be vastly different from each other. But we finally learned with the standard model that all of them are essentially the same kind of theory. Okay? The fact that they look different is a long-distance illusion. It's because there's some kind of, broadly speaking, there's dirt at very big distances that's obscuring the fact that essentially they look the same. They're described by the same kinds of mathematical equations. They're described by the same kinds of physical ideas. People talk a lot about speculative things like grand unified theories and things like that. But in a very profound sense, we've seen this notion of unification take place already. We've already seen that all these forces are described in the same language and in very much the same way. And in very much the same physical terms. For example, electromagnetism is associated with electrons interacting with photons. The weak force is associated with electrons and neutrinos interacting with something that's a lot like a photon, called the W particle. Now, this W particle happens to have a very big mass. The photon doesn't have a mass. That means that at very long distances, it was very hard to see this interaction. But that was just sort of an accident. If you go to short enough distances, they look basically the same. That distance was around 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, where this fundamental similarity first made its appearance. Similarly, the strong interactions. Again, exactly the same kind of picture. Quarks interact with gluons. Gluons happen to interact with themselves. There are some quantitative differences between them. And the actual exact strengths of these interactions are not exactly the same. You know, the strength of this interaction in some units is 1 over 100. The strength of this interaction in some units is 1 over 10. But they're not tremendously different. It's the same kind of apparatus, the same ideas. This is the reason we go to short distances, because we've learned over a century now that the essential simplicity and unity of the underlying laws of nature manifest themselves most clearly at short distances. We don't do it only because we care about the building blocks of matter or what things are made of and so on. That's also interesting. But that's not why most of us care about it. Most of us don't care about the actual particles that things are made of. What we care about are the laws that are governing everything. And the particles tell us about those laws. So you should think about the particles like the alphabet. We're interested in the novel. The laws, what governs the pattern of everything is what we're actually really interested in. And we go to short distances because we've learned that it's short distances where that pattern manifests itself most clearly. Okay. There's one thing which is left that we haven't confirmed in this picture of the standard model. Remember, I told you that we should have an answer to every question. Everything works down to 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, so you ask any question and the standard model gives you an answer to it. So here's a simple question. Why does the electron have a mass? Okay. The electron has a mass. That's very important. If the electron had no mass, atoms would be infinitely big. Okay. The electrons would be zipping around the speed of light. Electrons don't zip around the speed of light because they have a mass, so they can stay confined in atoms. And the standard model gives you an answer, and the answer looks a little bit peculiar. It's not quite as peculiar as I'm making it out to be, but this is unfortunately the best way of explaining it. Not technically. You can think of the world as being filled with a kind of fluid. If this sounds like the ether, don't worry, it's not like the ether. But there's a sense in which you can think of the world as being filled with a fluid. It's called the Higgs fluid or the Higgs condensate. But what happens is that an electron that moves through this condensate bangs into it every now and then. And it's that banging into it every now and then that gives it inertia. So it can't just zip around at the speed of light. The electron happens not to have a very big interaction with this condensate. Other particles have a much bigger interaction and have a much bigger mass. For example, a thing called the top quark has a much bigger mass, and this jitter happens much more. It gets knocked around a lot more. But there is a typical length scale that's common to all of these things for how far they go before they bang into this condensate. That's around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. So that, remember I told you this 10 to the minus 17 centimeters number is not just where we happen to be, it's associated with something else. This we just know. We know that that everything that's moving around, once around every 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, it bangs into the condensate and has an interaction. The photon happens to have no coupling at all, no interaction at all, which is why it just sails through this masses. But because this typical scale is around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, again, it's the same quantum mechanics picture over and over again, the LHC is just guaranteed to excite this fluid. So it's going to bang things into each other, probe 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. So it's going to put a little wiggle, 10 to the minus 17 centimeter wiggle into this fluid. That's like putting a little wave into the fluid. The waves that come out are interpreted as particles. It's called the Higgs particle. And that's the last part of the standard model that we haven't seen. So the LHC is essentially guaranteed to excite this Higgs particle and see it. So that's one thing that this Higgs particle is something like it. That's something that we essentially must see. We haven't seen it yet. If we don't see it, everything is wrong. If we don't see it, you know, quantum mechanics is wrong. The most basic things about the laws of nature are wrong. So we don't think something like that is, we don't think things are that badly wrong. So I think we're, I've said in a number of places that I would bet a year's salary that the Higgs would be discovered. A number of people have emailed me to take me up on the offer. Please don't email me. But anyway, if this is essentially something guaranteed to be discovered. Okay. But now I want to go and tell you in 10 minutes or so about what some of the major problems are and why we expect that there's a lot more going on that we're going to learn at the LHC. And this, again, all has to do with this quantum mechanical jitter that I told you about. I thought I would just put one slide up with a few simple equations in it, just so you could get some idea of what's going on. Everything that I'm going to tell you about in the next 10 minutes is going to have to do with the fact that even the vacuum, remember we saw the vacuum was exciting, there was particles and antiparticles coming out. It's going to have to do with the fact that even the vacuum has energy. And that's going to give rise to lots and lots of problems. And just to see why that is, if you imagine a ball sitting there on a spring, in a world that's classical, it could have no energy, because it could not be moving at all, so it could have zero kinetic energy, and the spring doesn't have to stretch at all, it would have zero potential energy. But quantum mechanically, that's impossible, again, because I can't know both where it's sitting and how fast it's going at the same time. And there's just an absolutely minimal amount of jitter that it has to have. And you can work out what it is, you don't have to follow this, but it has really a minimum amount of energy, which is given by that Planck's constant times the frequency of this oscillation. So there's no such thing as zero energy. Okay? Even the lowest energy state has some energy. And this gives rise to enormous problems. So let's take a little region of space. This little region of space has some quantum fluctuations in it, so it has some energy from what I just told you. Now it's like an even smaller region of space. You know, it's even bigger wiggles, even bigger energy, and an even smaller region of space. So this is terrible. There's an enormous energy per volume even in empty space. In fact, it looks like it's infinite. Because that would make the box arbitrarily small, the energy is big, the volume is small, the energy for either volume is just going to infinity.
Now, we can't make this box much smaller than that quantum that I told you about earlier.
Because, well, at that scale, everything's a black hole, and we have no idea what we're talking about anyway.
But let's say we took it down to these very, very short distances. This would just give us some estimate. It would give us an estimate for how much energy there is. How much energy there is in the vacuum.
That's a back-of-the-envelope estimate. Theoretical physicists are used to doing back-of-the-envelope estimates. And if they're any good, they're usually right to a factor of 10. Okay?
Here's, unfortunately, not right to a factor of 10. And I don't have to do any formulas. So that's really an enormous amount of energy. And we can ask, well, what would that energy do? Because E equals mc squared, that energy corresponds to having a lot of mass. That a lot of mass will give rise to a lot of gravity. And in fact, it would make the universe expand. It would make it expand at a very, very fast rate. You don't have to put any formulas in to know how fast that rate is, because every single number here is Planck.
Planck energy, Planck volume, there's gravity itself is associated with the Planck length, so everything is the word Planck.
So the rate at which the universe would be expanding would be like it would be doubling its size every, it would be 10 to the minus 33 centimeters big, or it would be doubling in size every 10 to the minus 43 seconds. That does not look like our world. In fact, it would be a lethal world.
Now, things get worse, because you might just think, we don't know what's going on. Somehow, this energy of the vacuum must be zero. If it isn't going to be so big, maybe it's got to be zero.
But the most important thing we learned in fundamental physics experiments in the last 20 or 30 years is that the universe actually is doubling in size at a uniform rate. It is accelerating. It isn't just expanding. It was expanding for a long time, decelerating. But very recently, a few billion years ago, it started accelerating.
Started doubling in size,
indeed.
So the simplest explanation for that is that there is an energy in the vacuum. But that energy in the vacuum is around 120 orders of magnitude smaller than that back-of-the-envelope estimate. Okay. So that back-of-the-envelope estimate gives you an answer that's 10 to the 120 times too big.
So this is the biggest error in the history of, I used to say physics, and then I thought, why am I
slandering other sciences?
I don't think anyone has made such a bad prediction ever. It's just 10 to the 120 orders of magnitude off. And I want to remind you, this is not the answer to some very esoteric question. It's not some sixth decimal place of some strange experiment. We're trying to answer, why is the universe, big, flat, old? And we apparently, if I do a back of the envelope estimate, I get things wrong by 10 to the 120. So I told you we have this amazingly successful theory, right?
It agrees with everything we've seen, right? So we must have an answer to this. So this is what we do.
This is what we actually do. We say, oh, this isn't the problem. The observed energy that we see, yes, there is that piece that we calculated from this quantum jitter. And let's say in some units, it doesn't even matter what the units are. It's 2.649378...53. That's 121st decimal place,
And there's another piece, by the way,
that was just sitting there to begin with, just classically, this was the quantum piece, it was a classical piece, that just happened to be negative 2.649378... They happened to agree to the first 120 decimal places.
No, we never started in the 121st decimal place. That's what we do. Okay. You can't stop me from doing that.
It's what we do. Okay, we can do that, and now everything is consistent. But this is crazy. Okay, this is like walking into a room and seeing a pencil standing on its table, on a table. Okay. That's possible. It's possible that it was arranged to stand on its table. It's not inconsistent. It's within 10 to the minus 120 degrees of vertical. But if you saw that, you would wonder that there's probably something up. There's probably something that you're missing. Now, as it turns out, there's a virtually identical problem with the origin of mass that I was mentioning earlier. Remember I told you that there are these collisions that take place every 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, but the same quantum jitter
would just want to be bigger and bigger and bigger at shorter and shorter distances. So the same back of the envelope estimate would lead you to suspect that this actually happens every 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, that Planck's lines again, and not every 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. So this observed 10 to the minus 17 centimeter value requires us to fine-tune our parameters now, not to 1 part in 10 to the 120, but to 1 part in 10 to the 30, a measly 1 part in 10 to the 30. That's still very bad. And again, this is not the answer to some esoteric question of some 6 decimal place in some experiment. This is the answer to why do we exist and aren't all black holes. Okay. If this adjustment didn't happen, gravity would be way stronger. The masses of all the particles would be way, way bigger. Gravity would be way stronger. We'd all be black holes. So this is the answer to the question, why is gravity so weak, is that we happen to do an adjustment of parameters of 1 part in 10 to the 30. So this is called fine-tuning for obvious reasons. And I want to just say that we have these large separation of scales. We have a macroscopic universe, which is governed by microscopic laws. That is a remarkable fact, as it turns out. And in order to explain why there's a macroscopic universe governed by microscopic laws, in our current theory, we have to have these very fine adjustments of the parameters. And if we don't do it, we have this very unpleasant universe. So we don't like these explanations. We think we're missing something. And the question is, what is it that's taming these violent quantum fluctuations of the vacuum? So what could it be? Well, if you saw a pencil standing on its tip in the middle of the table, you would look for a mechanism that would explain why it's vertical. Like maybe there's a string hanging from the ceiling. Or maybe if you look at very short distances, there's a little hand holding it up. That is what we are looking for. Okay? We're looking for the analog of little hand holding it up. We're looking for a mechanism that explains and tames these violent fluctuations in the vacuum. In the case of this problem of why gravity is so weak, what's incredibly interesting is that whatever this mechanism is, it must show up at 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. And that's just there because of the way I set up it. It's just built into the way I described the problem to you, right? Let's say it showed up at 10 to the minus 21 centimeters. Something new showed up then. All these fluctuations would go down to 10 to the minus 21 centimeters. Whatever, you know, where, unless things change, the things are just going to fluctuate. These quantum fluctuations will just get bigger and bigger. So if we're going to solve this problem, whatever tames it must show up at 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, not 10 to the minus 19, not 10 to the minus 23, right at 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. So this is one of the reasons the LHC is so exciting. Because, and it can't just be some garden variety random new thing. These fluctuations of space-time, these quantum mechanical fluctuations in space and time, as I showed you, is really built into the laws of quantum mechanics and special relativity. If something is going to tame them, it has to make a departure from those ideas in some way. And it's therefore not surprising that all the ways that are known, essentially all the ways that are known to deal with this problem, and there aren't that many, involve in some way extensions of our ideas of space and time. And whatever it is must show up at the LHC. Okay, so just in the last 5 minutes, let me tell you about one of them. And this is, in many ways, it's the most popular one, I think the one many of us think is most likely to show up, and is in many ways the most exciting possibility. Because as we'll see, it will really echo in a very direct way what we learned around 100 years ago with the discovery of antimatter. So supersymmetry is an extension of our ideas of space and time. And it's a kind of remarkable extension. Probably many of you have read about extra dimensions of space-time in popular books and lectures. Those extensions of space-time are really boring from a theoretical point of view. They're really boring because there are just other dimensions of space and time that are a lot like our own. They're just sort of more of them. Supersymmetry is not like that. It's an extension of our idea of space and time, which finds a kind of quantum partner of our normal notions of space and time. That makes it a little harder to talk about, but it's but from a theoretical point of view, more interesting. So and Just as special relativity and quantum mechanics doubled the world by introducing antiparticles, supersymmetry further doubles the world by adding, in addition to all matter particles having matter and antimatter, now matter and antimatter, everything, has yet another set of properties. Again, particles of very, very similar properties. It turns out they have, they're slightly different, but they essentially have very, very similar properties. And so if this is right, the other half of the world is awaiting us at the LHC. So the picture is something like this, that we have our ordinary dimensions of space and time. So if I have an electron that's wandering around, all these are their ordinary dimensions of space and time. But in addition to ordinary dimensions, there's another dimension. Now, I keep calling it a quantum dimension because this is a very weird kind of dimension. See, normally, if I call this the x-axis, I can keep walking as much as I want in the x-axis. No one stops me from going as far as I want. These quantum dimensions are funny. You can't take more than one step in them. If you take two steps, you die. And that's not, you know, those of you who are familiar with the Pauli exclusion principle, that you can't put electrons in the same state, you can't have two electrons in the same state. It's in that sense, almost precisely in that sense, that you can go one step, but you can't have two things. You can't take two steps in these directions. So they're kind of funny dimensions that you can only step in once. But if we take the same electron that's moving along this way, and if it happens to take a step in the quantum dimension, its projection on our own world looks like a particle of virtually identical properties, except differences. Okay? It's called the superpartner of the electron, so everything has one superpartner because you can't take more than one step in this direction. Okay? But it's called the selectron, the superpartner of the electron. And so every particle has a partner like this. For example, the photon has a partner called the photino. But because things there are essentially symmetrical as things here, for example, the electron, and the photon have some interaction with each other. That interaction strength is identical to if we had them move in this direction, the selectron, the electron, and the photino. The way they differ is that the electron you can think of as spinning like a little magnet. So it has a spin. All the particles have an intrinsic spin. The selectron happens to have zero spin. So the partners and the superpartners differ in their spin. But in their mass, we haven't seen these selectrons yet. That's because it takes a certain amount of energy to pop things off into these quantum dimensions. But once again, if we go to high enough energies, remember, all the differences are long-distance illusions. If we went to sufficiently high energies, everything would look completely symmetrical between our ordinary dimensions and these quantum dimensions. And the way these solve this problem that I mentioned is, roughly speaking, that, remember, we took this box, we made the box smaller and smaller, and we got these bigger and bigger quantum jitters. But now, at very small distances, there wants to be a symmetry between these quantum dimensions and our ordinary dimensions. But because you can't take more than one step at a time in the quantum dimensions, you can't jitter a lot. You can only jitter once. Okay? So the jitters, therefore, the compromise is that the jitter's got to stop. The jitter stops at around the length scale where finally you see the quantum dimension that you can pop off. So this is a way in which this quantum extension of our notion of space-time removes this fundamental fact of the world. The quantum fluctuations that we talked about are built into quantum mechanics, space and time. This extension of space-time removes them. So if this solves the problem we were talking about, we must see the superpartners at the LHC. Okay? Because again, it couldn't happen at 10 to the minus 23 centimeters because it would still leave us with the same problem. So what will actually happen is that we'll take these protons, they'll smash into each other, with enough energy, we can pop the particles off into the quantum dimensions. So I can pop quarks off into the quantum dimensions, and they'll look, in our world, like squarks. Superpartner of the quarks. I'm very sorry for the names. This is the 1970s, you know. I think our field should apologize for these names collectively. But anyway, we can't do anything about it. So, and again, these particles decay very, very rapidly. So this quark will rapidly decay to a quark, for example, in a photino. This quark on the other side, it doesn't always have to be that simple. This quark can do a quark and a W eno. That was the weak interaction particle, its superparticle. The W eno can decay to a selectron and an electron. A selectron can decay to an anti-electron and a photino, and so on. Okay? And this is all happening in 10 to the minus 27 seconds. So what comes out of this is the spread of particles. And we have to, and our experimental colleagues have to work very hard and be incredibly clever in order to be able to extract this, study it, see what it is, and piece back that this is what was going on, if it's going on. I circle something here because it's extremely interesting. This photino is, it's a massive particle. Like the photon, it has no electric charge. And because of that, it has very weak interactions with everything. So it actually isn't seen directly in these detectors. Those giant detectors will stop all the rest of the stuff and will study it, but will not see these photinos. So the way you know they're there is that there's some energy that's missing that you can't account for. So from the pattern of the energy that's missing, you can try to detect that there are these very massive, that there are these massive neutral particles floating around. Now, one of the really cool things about supersymmetry is that it's invented to solve this essential theoretical paradox that I told you about. But it gives you two remarkable bonuses for free. And whenever that happens in physics, it normally means the theory is on the right track. One bonus are these particles that are neutral and stable, basically stable and heavy. There appears to be a need for such a particle, not in particle physics, but in cosmology, because it appears that a lot of the matter in the world is dark. Cosmologists have thought for a long time that there is dark matter. There's lots and lots of evidence for it. Very recently, there was this... this is just a particularly fun picture of two colliding galaxies. And in the picture, there's almost all the matter in the world is dark. So if you take a galaxy, it's surrounded by a large halo of dark matter. It's around 100 times bigger than the galaxy itself. So when you have this galaxy and that galaxy and they smash into each other, the matter, the normal stuff that we see in the galaxy is, and where the dark matter is, can get separated from each other. And we can look for, we can try to see by gravitational means where most of the galaxy is. So that's done by something called gravitational lensing. It doesn't matter, the details don't matter here, other than just to see very, very directly that where the ordinary gaseous matter and the dark matter is can very clearly be seen to be separated from each other. Now more and more direct evidence of this dark matter actually exists. Purely from the point of view of cosmology, you could ask, if I never told you anything about this lecture, you could ask, what is a good candidate for this dark matter particle? There's lots of them, but there's one that's particularly nice and singled out, which happens to be a particle whose mass is around 100 to 1,000 times the mass of the proton. That's neutral. And that's an argument totally independent of everything that I told you, that the LHC must see something. And in the particular case of supersymmetry, the photino is an excellent candidate for what that particle might be. Okay? So I find it very poetic, because in this case, if supersymmetry is right, it could very well be that the dark matter is actually light. But it's light moving in these quantum dimensions. And there's another reason that we think these ideas are on the right track. Remember I told you that if you take the picture, here's an electron, and in quantum mechanically, surrounded by this cloud of particles, that has a very interesting consequence that's been measured to great accuracy, and the 2004 Nobel Prize is associated with this discovery, actually. That if you try to measure what that charge is, you'll get a different answer at different distances. Because when you go to shorter distances, you're piercing this cloud more and more, and you see the charge change. So it changes with a very specific rule that we can calculate. And we can take, in the standard model, we can take the strength of electromagnetism. Remember I told you they were all just numbers, like 1/100th and 1/10th. So here I've plotted their inverse, so that's the biggest and that's the smallest. But we can take it to the standard model and extrapolate to shorter distances, and we find they kind of vaguely come together. That's kind of cool. These forces seem to be different, quantitatively different, but they seem to be getting closer to each other. But they don't quite, they're all kind of qualitatively get closer to each other. However, if we have these superpartners, which were motivated, as I said, from completely different considerations that I told you about, they start at 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. It turns out that these three forces converge to shocking accuracy, around 1% accuracy, and they all three hit each other. So this is very sharp evidence that somehow there's unification between all these different forces. Their strengths become exactly the same at incredibly short distance. That only happens if they're supersymmetric. Okay, and that distance is around 10 to the minus 30 centimeters, which just happens to be not so far from where gravity becomes comparable to everything else. This is the strongest hint we have that there is circumstantial hint, but a very strong hint that there really is something to the idea that there is a fundamental unifying force theory for everything that governs physics at these very, very short distances. Okay. All right, so let me just, so that's one of the candidates. Supersymmetry is one of the candidates for what we might see. There are others. As I said, they all involve an extension to our idea of space-time. So let me just close by telling you what the game plan is going to look like for the next 3 years or so. These protons that collide with each other, the rates at which things happen, remember I told you most of the time they just smash into each other and they break apart. That happens around 10 billion times a second, about a billion times a second. Okay, so a billion times a second, protons smash into each other and they go splat. Every now and then, around 100 times a second, they're basically going splat, but they just accidentally come off at big angles. Okay, because it's happening so frequently, it's 10 billion times. It's a billion times a second. Accidentally, every now and then, around 100 times a second, they'll come off at a decent angle. Around 10 times a second, we'll make some of the particles that we know and love in the standard model, like the top quark. It's happening around 10 times a second. Out of all of this, we have to dig out making these quarks. Okay, that's going to be happening around one time a minute or so. Okay. So that's a lot. That's great, right? You have this machine. It's wonderful. It's working. We're going to be making quark pairs every minute, maybe if we're lucky, every second. But it has to be dug out from all of these things that are happening much, much more frequently. So this is why our experimental colleagues are wonderfully ingenious people. And it's really like looking for a needle in a haystack. But I just want to give you a very qualitative idea of how it's done. The way it's done is that there are lots and lots of these events that come just from the standard model, nothing else. But they get smaller and smaller as you go to higher and higher energies. Because in the standard model, there's nothing new happening at higher energies. So even though there's many, many events, they should get fewer and fewer of them as the particles that you measure coming out are more and more energetic. So, but if there are things like supersymmetry or other new physics, they should show up as a little bump. So there's many, many fewer of them, but they should be somewhere where there's even fewer standard model particles that are being made. This is a cartoon. This is why our experimental colleagues, worked very hard is to figure out actually how to do this in practice. But I really want to emphasize that it's a sort of heroic undertaking. But there's every indication that it should work. All right. So that's it. This is the schedule. I believe it still hasn't changed. Maybe one of my colleagues can tell me if it has. But what's going on right now is that this ring is being cooled. Okay, all these magnets, I forgot to tell you, these magnets are all superconducting magnets. They've got to be cooled to get these very, very high magnetic fields. And there's a schedule for schedule for cooling everything. The last part that gets cooled down in arcs, the last part to be cooled down, I think, is still scheduled to be finished in May, and to begin these collisions sometime in the summer, probably the fall of this year. So that's the message I wanted to leave you with. theoretical speculation, and I think there's really excellent reason to suspect that something is happening, but we should really start knowing if the machine really turns on this year, which it should, we should really have something solid to say by 2010. Thank you.
Yes. The question is that there are some ideas which. The question is that there are some ideas about making little black holes. It's possible the LHC would make little. It's possible the LHC might make little black holes in a different scenario than the one that I talked about. In this different scenario, the reason why gravity, what solves this problem of these big fluctuations, is that actually gravity isn't fundamentally actually all that much weaker than all the other forces. Gravity really catches up with all the other forces at around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, but it's diluting its strength by leaking out into extra dimensions of space. And so it's possible in that scenario that we might make little microscopic black holes at the LHC. And Scott is one of the people who's made very large contributions to understanding what would happen and what that would look like. There's nothing to worry about with these black holes. You make them and they decay in 10 to the minus 27 seconds into ordinary particles. But the way that works is really by saying that this extrapolation to 10 to the minus 33 centimeters is a theoretical one, and that actually gravity gets stronger at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So if that's true, we'll know that as well. I chose to focus on one scenario for what we might see. There are a couple of other ones. I think most people still think this is the most possible.
Is there something special about being chosen as a spot?
No, I mean it's just it's where the European Laboratory for Particle Physics has been for about 50 years, and right now the highest energy accelerator in the world is just outside Chicago. And as I said, it has an energy that's 7 times smaller. These aren't things that you can sort of, that a group of people can just decide tomorrow, hey, let's build an accelerator. There's an enormous body of knowledge and expertise, and there are only a few things around the world. So it's natural that they happen in places where
there's international financing.
Yes, I mean, well, it's this is a very important point. The United States could have had an accelerator even more powerful than the LHC that was canceled in 1993, it was canceled for very, very short-sighted reasons, that means that really the center of gravity of experiment in the subject, which is really the heart and soul in the end, has actually shifted to Europe. So this machine costs something like $3 billion to make, and the U.S. has about a $500 million amount of participation in it. That being said, I think many of us still hope and believe that temperamentally, the U.S. physicists will be best suited to making the fundamental discoveries, and are definitely playing a leading role in the experiments.
How much data will the LHC produce, and how much time will it take to get through
that? That's an excellent question. I was going to I forgot to mention it. Per year, it collects around 15 petabytes of data. So, just so you know, that would take, a CD rack something like 30 kilometers tall to contain that data per year.
In fact, the data is there's so much of it, it can't even be all housed in one place. Okay, so some of it is housed in Geneva, some of it is housed at the Fermilab, it's outside Chicago, it's Cleveland Shares, where it's housed. The amount of time it takes to go through it and analyze it is, it depends on what's going on, partially. It depends on the nature of the physics that is being seen. But this is not just to give you a figure of merit. I mean, I showed you that we might be making these squirts one a minute, you know, one a second. That's very, very rapidly. That means, you know, in months, two or three months, you might have lots of them. But it'll take probably on order 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, depending on exactly what's going on, to analyze it with some confidence, to know that you're seeing something new. So that's the sort of time scale that we're talking about. I should say also, kind of ironically, the one thing that I told you we're guaranteed to see, this Higgs particle, that could come quite a bit later than all these other things for some detailed reasons. Even though we'd be making it with a very, very large ray, the dominant way it would decay and show up turns out to be swamped by other things. So you have to look for it in a much rarer way that it's produced and decays. So it could well be that it's 2010 or 2011 till we're confident we've seen the Higgs. And it could be, you know, earlier than that, but we're confident we've seen the other stuff. Yes?
Could you please discuss the efforts being made to find evidence for quantum gravity at the LHC?
Right. Yeah, that's again this second scenario that's also related to the issue of whether we'll see micro black holes, and that's I can draw the idea for so it could be that this 10 to the minus 17 centimeter scale is actually where gravity catches up with everything else. Let me just draw, and if that's the case, you can ask, well, why does gravity look, why does it look so weak? And it looks so weak because while all the other forces that we know and love, like electricity, spreads out in our ordinary three-dimensional space, it's like confined to living on a sheet, three-dimensional sheet. There's actually extra dimensions of space that are a lot larger, okay? Where gravity, so this is gravity, can now dilute itself. So this is possible, if this happens, for this to solve that problem that I mentioned, for this to solve the quantum jitter problem, the way this solves it is by saying that the shortest distance that actually makes sense isn't 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, but it's 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. Okay. And that's why the jitters are gone. So that's another big change to our idea of space and time. There have to be some extra dimensions around, and gravity is diluting its strength in them. But what would happen in this scenario at the LHC is that you could probe quantum gravity. You could bang these quarks into each other in the proton, and you could make things. You could make gravitons. Gravitons could go taking off into the extra dimensions. Or you could make a little macroscopic black hole that then would evaporate. Or if string theory is the correct theory of quantum gravity, you could make strings. You would actually be able to see it directly. And in fact, this scenario and the one that I mentioned are essentially all ideas of some variation. I mean, they can be quantitatively very different, but they're essentially variations on the same two ideas. Okay? And there are these two ways that we can extend the notion of space-time. One with sort of ordinary dimensions, and one with these quantum dimensions. Yeah.
And how would we know if what we're seeing is a graviton?
Yeah. So that's again, that would show up as energy that's missing in this case. You might say, well, I told you that the way the photinos show up is an energy that's missing, and this is energy that's missing. But it's missing in quantitatively very, very different ways. So you should be able to tell the two of them apart from each other. And actually, sometimes in other versions of theories like this, you would actually make the gravitons, and the extra dimensions would be a lot smaller. They wouldn't go very far, and they would come back, and they would decay into ordinary particles. And in that scenario, you would really be able to say that you're seeing something that looks like a graviton. on, and you'd be able to study its decay products. And the detailed way that things come out would unambiguously point back to the epidemic. Yes?
To identify something with missing energy means that you have to be confident that you accounted for everything.
Right. And that's why they have these gigantic detectors that cover as much as they can of everything. That's part of the point. Yeah, that's right. So you're right, and they are. So.
Okay.
Yes.
Has there been any? Is there any effort to use distributed computing, like screensavers, to plow through the data that we could?
I don't think so. Maybe one of my experimental colleagues here would care to answer that question. But this data has got to be analyzed. The data has got to be analyzed by in an extremely specialized way, and very very few people get to look at the data. For example, it's not just people with their laptops who don't get to look at the data. You know, theoretical physicists don't get to look at the data. So the experimentalists guard their data very, very, very carefully for a very good reason. It's not easy to analyze, and you need it's. No, you can only see things that where you are, which is 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. To see 10 to the minus 23 centimeters, you need a much more powerful microscope, and 16 orders of magnitude smaller, you need 16 orders of magnitude bigger energies. So that would be an accelerator about as big as the galaxy. Probably able to get up to those bigger energies.
So unfortunately, that means that if it's really true that gravity catches up with all the other forces at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, it'll be very hard to get direct experimental information about what's going on there.
Although the theoretical issues that are involved are completely fascinating, and many people have been thinking about them for 30 years, and it's not an empty pursuit, even though it's hard to get experimental data. Some of the problems are so sharply posed that if you make progress on them, even theoretically, through knowing, it doesn't mean that nature necessarily works that way. But there's a beautiful set of questions there that people are working hard on, and will continue to work hard on regardless of what happens with the LHC. Those problems aren't going away.
It might
be that gravity actually gets strong in the second scenario, with 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, in which case everyone's very happy. And those same questions turn into experimental science.
Okay, let's thank Eva.